going on in your world?
Why not?
Tune in to UFO Undercover, Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern, with your host, Joe Montaldo, right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Welcome to another episode of The Dawn of Shades. I'm your host, Gia Scott, and today is March 29th, 2011, and this is episode 501. More about this program and the guests that have provided us with such fascinating conversations can be found on our website, www.exogenynetwork.com. The Dawn of Shades always tries to bring interesting people right to the audience to hear about both new and old ideas. We focus on the people, places, and ideas that don't always make the mainstream news, the kinds of things that are frequently labeled as alternative or paranormal. Now, for the show tonight, if you would like to have a question asked, you can email it to me at gscott@exogenynetwork.com. You can give us a phone call at 504-273-7379 and come live on the air with us, or you can send it through the virtual auditorium on PalTalk by text. I do monitor the email during the program, so if you're listening outside of the virtual auditorium and the United States and want your question answered, please go ahead and email it to me, and I'll get it asked for you. In the virtual auditorium, you can put it into text, and I'll try and catch it as the screen scrolls. If I don't catch it the first time, feel free to repeat it again. For those of you who are listening in on a podcast, you can go ahead and email me as well. I'll try to get your questions answered for you, too. And for those of you who like to feel connected, you can find me on Facebook and Twitter. You can link to me there. There's also a Dawn of Shades fan page on Facebook, so you can look for that too. For the readers, campers, and foodies, check out the articles and blogs. You might find some material that just might interest you. Now, today is our anniversary program, and we are now embarking on our 5th year of broadcasting on the Paranormal Radio Network. For that, I wish to thank PRN, Joe Montaldo, Exogeny Network, and each and every listener that has listened to the many programs we have produced live and recorded for podcasting. I've enjoyed the time we have spent together. The Dawn of Shades has evolved considerably from its early days, and it's been a fascinating time to share each week. Now tonight, as we embark on a new segment of our journey, we have Michael Clarkson joining us for the first hour, and Sean Bellacuro for the second. Both are authors and are sure to greatly enlighten us about the ghostly apparitions that their books take a look at. Michael, would you be so kind as to introduce yourself to the audience?
First of all, happy anniversary, Jim. That's a blank check there, letting me introduce myself, but I'll try. I guess I come to this subject, G, as a, sort of a skeptic, because most of my background is in daily newspapers for actually 37 years. I was a newspaper reporter and investigative journalist. I covered police reporting for about 13 years and some sports reporting, some health reporting. I went on to write, this is my 7th book. I've written 5 books that are generally about fear. I think there's a bit of a tie-in here with our fear energy into some of these poltergeist mental states. But and I'm married, have 2 sons, whom I still play soccer with, so I try to keep up with them. And otherwise, that's me. I'm living in Fort Erie, Ontario right now.
Okay. You've had a very, very busy career. So whatever did make you write about poltergeists?
Sure. It's something, gee, I've had on the back burner for about, believe it or not, 30 years. There was a case in 1980. Actually, the case was 1970, but I saw a young man involved in the case in 1980 for an anniversary story of a young boy, and there seemed to be poltergeist activity centered around him in St. Catharines, Ontario. And there were there was a whole shift of police officers who swear they saw chairs moving on their own and beds and paintings falling off the wall. So this young man came to my house around whom this activity centered 10 years later, and things he told me, and I knew the police officers involved, and the fact that they went back to their police station and made reports on it made me think that there may be something to this. So make a long story semi-short, I've been collecting poltergeist cases ever since then, looking at them interestingly, shelving them, wondering what I could do with it. I have not entered this realm lately because, as I say, when you're in newspapers for 37 years, you tend to be skeptical, even leaning sometimes towards cynical, although I hope the day never comes when I'm cynical. But I think this is an interesting subject. I know I've already taken a hit because of the stigma involved with paranormal in some people's eyes. My credibility's taken a bit of a hit, but I knew that going in, that it was a better risk. But I've always enjoyed risk-taking projects.
Yeah. Well, you know, a lot of people who don't really believe in ghosts, per se, do believe in poltergeist activity and use a number of explanations ranging from excess psychokinetic energies from adolescence to, other fairly scientific and less paranormal sort of explanations for it. You know, what's your take on that?
Sure. Well, first of all, I wouldn't consider myself a believer or a disbeliever. I come to this as a journalist, and I reviewed 75 cases. I found, quite a number of common denominators in these cases. In fact, after these reviewing them, I believe, if there's that word again, at least the people involved in these 75 cases are telling me that we're dealing here generally with haunted people as opposed to haunted buildings or possession. In other words, the movements of objects, the things that go bump in the day, seem to center around people, and mostly young people who have an unusual brain, perhaps, unusual energy, and they're frustrated. It's a very rare occurrence, very rarely reported for a number of reasons. The main reason is that families are usually embarrassed about this activity going on in their home. They don't want people coming in, neighbors, police, media. But I think it's a subject worth looking at more closely, even from a skeptical angle. Now, I don't want to throw out the spirit theory entirely. In fact, I've got a whole chapter in my book on perhaps alleged links to spirits who are going into the minds of these young people and helping them to make objects move. But if you want me to go into a little more detail right now, I can give you a little more detailed definition of what I found poltergeists are.
Sure, go ahead.
Sure. Well, there's a semi-retired parapsychologist in Georgia by the name of William Roll, R-O-L-L. He studied hundreds and hundreds of poltergeist cases over the years, and he came up a number of years ago with a term called recurrent spontaneous psychokinesis. It's RSPK for short, and his definition of that is bizarre movements of objects, noises, and other paranormal effects caused unconsciously by a person, otherwise known as poltergeist activity. Now, unlike psychokinesis, or PK, which I think is a close cousin, RSPK occurs spontaneously and repeatedly over a period of time. And as I say, I found a number of common denominators. Now, if you bear with me, this is really, I think, a mystery wrapped up in an enigma. But although each case has its own characteristics and idiosyncrasies, and I'm really not closing the book on any theory, but I found that generally these cases have a poltergeist agent, usually an adolescent entering puberty, immediately around whom these strange activities occur. Now, he or she is usually above average in intelligence. Next common denominator is that there seems to be some sort of repression or frustration of the poltergeist agent by others in the house. It seems like they don't have any other way to express themselves rather than this paranormal phenomena. Usually there's a high level of stress in the household prior to the start of the activity and continuing through the case. Most of these cases are not long-winded. I would say the average is probably several weeks. 1 week, several months is the usual lifespan, but there are exceptions to everything. There was a case in London, what seems to last for more than a year. And these cases share usually dramatic events, such as unexplained knocking, electrical malfunctions, movements of objects and furniture. Occasionally reported are levitation of objects, electrical appliances working without power, and sometimes fires starting on their own. And finally, the other dynamic, which tends to be common among these 75 cases, is that the poltergeist agent seems to have a mischievous intent rather than a harmful intent. Now, I have found about a dozen cases where people have been injured by flying objects, but none of them seriously. It seems like, it's a mischievous intent on the part of the agent. Now, that's all good and fine, but there's even more to this, more layers to this. In fact, I was going to call this book Psychic Tantrums because I think it's got a lot to do with the brain and unusual brains. There's so many components what seemingly have to come together, you could really call it a perfect psychic storm. Now, they found some of these young people, after the fact, tested that they seem to have unique brains. There's a slightly higher rate of epilepsy and schizophrenia among the poltergeist agents. There was a parapsychologist, he's no longer with us, his name was Andrew Green of London, England, and he said some of the agents suffered from a front temporal lobe epilepsy. It's a brain disorder in which people can suffer blackouts lasting from about a minute to half an hour, and during these blackouts, an unknown power of the mind may be released, which can cause objects to move. Now, beyond that, it seems that these agents are not only unusual brained, but they are tapping into nearby energy sources, whether it's something as simple as household electricity in the room when these movements of objects are occurring, or there's geomagnetic storms going on in the area, magnetic fields, perhaps, in the area of the building, and even something as simple as electricity from our mind body. I think, Gia, your listeners may be able to relate to this, that we do indeed have electricity in the beat of our heart, and we have electrical signals moving along our cells. And when you walk across a carpet, of course, your body can pick up or rub off extra electrons, and this slightly changes your body's electrical potential. And then, of course, when you touch the doorknob, zap. So,
we all experience that.
Yeah, and one other little sidelight to why it seems to be happening. Many of these adolescents seem to be going through puberty at the time. And there is a parapsychologist in London by the name of Guy Leon Playfair. Now, he traced the problems of a poltergeist case in London in 1977 to an 11-year-old girl, partly due to the fact she was entering puberty. He believed this was related to her pineal gland. Now, I'm not a scientist or a medic, but this gland is located at the center of the brain, and it's responsible for controlling and the release of sexual hormones. Playfair and some other parapsychologists believe that during puberty, this gland can create a type of creative energy. So it seems like there's some type of energy at work here, but I think it's such a rare event, and it seems to be a perfect psychic storm, and that is the other reason I think poltergeist cases, genuine poltergeist cases, are reported so infrequently around the world.
Well, you know, I can kind of understand it. I'm interested in it because when I was a teenager going through puberty or in my early teens, along with my brother and sister, and we were like stair steps, you know, so they were right behind me, we experienced poltergeist activity in our house.
Wow.
And including a fire in which our refrigerator burst into flames, but was appeared to be unharmed. Now, my mother did replace the refrigerator, but it was stood on the wall the whole bit, but there was no damage to the refrigerator, no melted wires, no nothing, just the soot. And, you know, the flying pots and pans, you know, the dishes would fly across the kitchen. And it usually, most things, barring the fire happened in the daytime. The other things usually happened shortly after we went to sleep.
I should have been.
And, you know, it would be this huge noise, and of course everybody in the house would wake up and go downstairs to find that there were pots and pans and dishes everywhere in the kitchen. And
what
this happened off and on for about 2 years.
Oh, my goodness. What did you, at the time, did you have a theory, or were there any suspects or anything?
Well, not really. It was just kind of blown off as psychic or poltergeist activity. And, you know, the general consensus was, we got three kids going through puberty, it'll go away. And it did.
Oh.
You know, that was it. You know, it wasn't regarded as a big deal. It was a little inconvenient, especially like replacing a refrigerator. Occasionally dishes would get broken flying across the kitchen. We never saw these flying items.
Oh.
You would hear the noise, and you would go downstairs and discover that the dishes were everywhere.
Well, did any three of you, obviously you're in the paranormal field, but what about your other two siblings? Did they turned out to be, for lack of a better word, let's say psychic?
Well, my sister has had an interest in shamanism. She's currently retired. My brother's an entrepreneur and has very little interest in anything paranormal.
Yeah. But you are, obviously.
Yeah, you know, I've always had an ongoing interest with it, and it probably does date from weird events that have happened, you know, since early childhood, apparently. Much to my surprise, one time a group of us, including my mother and my daughter, were touring a haunted hotel where we were going to be having dinner. And my mother shocked me. She announced all to everyone that if there was a ghost, it would appear, because I had always been a ghost magnet. And I was like, I don't remember being a ghost magnet. So apparently, you know, it wasn't uncommon for things to be seen in my vicinity even as a young child. I don't remember anything like that, but, you know.
Did you know?
But I always have had an interest in it.
Yeah.
Do I know what ghosts are? No.
I know you're the host of the show, but I'm just going to ask you one more question. Have you had any experience later on after childhood with psychokinesis? Moving things with your mind?
You know, not where I would say, yes, I was the source of it. You know,
okay.
I couldn't say that, no, that I believe that I have the ability to move objects. You know, there's been occasions where things have done odd things. I could have been. It could have been somebody else. You know, I don't know how. You know, I used to keep a string of camel bells on my door so that I could hear if the kids went out the door.
Yeah.
And there have been occasions where I saw those bells start swinging for no reason and ringing.
Well,
I don't know why or how, but it happened. Who did it? I don't know.
Yeah, your case a little bit similar to a case that's going on right now in Canada. I cannot use this woman's name because, ironically, almost unbelievably, she is trained to be a scientist, but she's had poltergeist activity reportedly and now psychokinesis. She doesn't want her husband to know, but I have a whole chapter in my book. Her name is Sarah. Now, Sarah's story is that she claims to have had poltergeist energy for many years. Usually when her husband gets her upset, things move in the house, things as heavy as appliances, washers, dryers. She sees it as quite a negative energy. And if I can back up for a minute, she had an automobile accident maybe 15, 20 years ago, and she seems to think somehow it changed her brain. Since she had the accident, not only has she had poltergeist activity, but she's been seeing the ghosts of her relatives, particularly her grandparents. She's been seeing white lights and other phenomena. Now, she doesn't exactly know why this is, but she suspects her brain has been altered somewhat. Now, she hates this poltergeist energy. She calls it very negative energy. She's been trying to get rid of it for many years. And she's in her mid-40s now, which makes this case highly unusual. But she has tried to change the RSPK, or the recurrent spontaneous psychokinesis, into psychokinesis, which is more as a more conscious moving things with her mind. She has made a homemade pinwheel out of a pencil and a little bit of paper as a wheel on the top. And what she tries to do, Gia, is move the pinwheel by focusing tightly with her mind. She claims she's done this many times, and she went to Laurentian University in Sudbury, Canada, to be tested by a very respected neuroscientist by the name of Dr. Michael Persinger. She felt a little bit under pressure at the time, and she couldn't make the pinwheel move in front of him. However, she went back to her hotel that night, and Persinger said, if you feel more relaxed and you feel you can do it again, call me, I'll come over. He couldn't come over, but his young assistant did, and allegedly he saw the pinwheel move. Now, I thought, well, this is good for my book. I phoned Persinger and said, do you mind if I interview this young man? And he said, absolutely not. If you use his name in a book and link that to poltergeist energy or the paranormal, this young man's going to get blackballed from ever getting a job in mainstream science. So that's one of the sidelights of this case, but it continues from there. Sarah came home, and I found out about her through William Rowe, the parapsychologist I mentioned earlier, who coined the phrase RSPK. And Sarah ended up giving me a demonstration of her PK on Skype, on a computer Skype. In fact, I've been told it's probably one of the first interviews of a paranormal subject on Skype. However, this was this past summer, and yes, indeed, the pinwheel was moving round and around. She was holding it on the pencil on her lap, and for 20 minutes I watched it go round and round, clockwise, sometimes counterclockwise. I suppose it could have gone all night, and I suppose that she could have had a wire attached to it, but as I said earlier, I'm fairly skeptical. I think I'm a better than average witness because of my training, and I was pretty impressed by what was going on there. But just to close off this case, as I say, Sarah is studying to be a scientist, which makes it even more complex. She's now working on her PhD, and she told me, I'm going to quote her, intuitive knowledge wasn't enough for me anymore. She's talking about her accident and talking about her RSPK experiences. I wanted to know why things are the way they are. Somehow, the accident turned me into a scientist. I'm pretty much stuck between two worlds, both figuratively speaking and literally. She says that if she had not had her experiences, she would likely be a disbelieving skeptic. Again, I quote her, I don't like being associated with the New Agers or the people not willing to test their own experiences. Rather, I want to bring science to these things because a lot of people need answers. I think my experiences can hold up to investigations. Sometimes I struggle with wanting to be a scientist while slipping into scientism out of habit because it feels safe and familiar. I just think that's a very, very rich and very multi-layered case.
Yeah, it is. And I found it fascinating because as you were talking, it reminded me, you know, asking me about current psychokinetic activity. There was a game. I played it with my mother and my siblings as a kid, and I played it with my own children. And you have a candle lit. And the game is simply, you move the flame. You make it long and skinny, or you make it short and fat, or you make it sway to one side or the other. Apparently we do that because we did it. Are we doing it through psychokinetic abilities somehow? I don't know how else we're doing it, but that was a game we played.
Was this in like the fireplace?
No, you light a candle and set it on the table.
Huh.
It was one of those things that you do like when the power was out or you're camping or whatever, you know, just light a candle. It was something that was, I guess, calming for everybody because you had to focus on the candle.
Oh, I never heard that one before, but that does remind me a bit of spoon bending. You remember Uri Geller became quite famous for staring at spoons and cutlery and then bending, touching them, bending them. There was a famous author, a fictional author, his name was Michael Crichton. And he said in his book in 1988 called Travels that he had a successful experience with PK at a spoon-bending party. Now, here are some of his observations. He said, "I bent a spoon and I knew it wasn't a trick. I looked around the room and saw little children, 8 or 9 years old, bending large metal bars." And he said, "The only thing he really noticed was that the spoon bending seemed to require a focused inattention. Not attention like Sarah with her pinwheel, but an inattention. He said, you had to try to get it to bend, and then you had to forget about it. Maybe talk to someone else while you rub the spoon or look around the room. Change your attention. That's when it was likely to bend." And he also said that this seems to me to confirm the idea that so-called psychic or paranormal phenomena are misnamed. There's nothing abnormal about them. On the other hand, they're utterly normal. We've just forgotten we can do them. The minute we do them, we recognize them for what they are, and then we think, so what? I thought that was an interesting quote and relates a little bit to, I guess, when you were younger and moving the flame around and you didn't think much about it. It seemed natural.
No, and my kids didn't think anything about it either. It was just, can you make it short and fat? Can you make it tall and skinny? Can you make it move to the left? Can you make it move to the right? And, you know, it wasn't a big deal. It was simply, it was kind of like a card game. It had no meaning.
Well,
it was just something to do.
You haven't got to Vegas, have you, and tried to interfere with the machines there, the slot machines?
No, I have to admit, I'm not even much of a gambler. I live in Mississippi. We've got casinos all along the coast. And I've probably, in the last 8 years, spent, maybe $40 or $50. It's just not something that I regard as particularly interesting, I guess. It doesn't make sense to me.
You're not trying to exploit your gifts, in other words?
Well, I wouldn't go as far as necessarily as saying it's a gift, or that I'm particularly psychic. But, you know, in talking to people who are much more psychic than me, at least much more aware of their abilities, it seems that you can only use them in a limited sort of way to benefit yourself. And I don't understand why that would be. You can use them, you know, the psychokinetic abilities have been associated with emergencies in which, say, a car has rolled over on your child or some other big, you know, big deal, and they've been associated with getting your loved one free. Okay, it's okay to do that, but it's not okay to help me win the lottery? You know, I fail to see.
I see what you mean.
I just fail to see the connection. Why, unless it's some sort of common sort of a psychological quirk, why would you be unable to use your psychic abilities to benefit yourself financially?
I think
that doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah, I think there may be more than one thing at work here, Gia. I think, yes, there may be psychic abilities on one hand, but you've also described what I call a fight-or-flight experience. When you save someone, you get, when you think someone has their life in danger, your body goes through a whole series of chemical changes to help you deal with a situation. It's simply called fight-or-flight. Now, your listeners out there,
right,
every one of them has 35 to 40 times a day has their fight or flight system kick in, but usually it's in very small increments. So we know that as stress. When you're challenged in anything, your body goes through a series of changes, and depending on what your brain interprets as being serious, then you won't get the big bang, in other words, over, you know, your kid dropping milk on the carpet, but you may get a little perturbed. But what I'm referring to here are not only physical abilities, but mental abilities. I've studied fear for so many years. I actually came up with a formula to help myself in pressure situations and deadline pressure when I was playing sports to use my mental abilities. Now, I'm not going to say it's mind over matter, but I suppose an argument, a good lawyer could make that argument I've had some crazy things happen in basketball games, for instance, where I've seen where I've had perfect games, like in the zone, I'd call it the zone, where I haven't missed a shot. And all those times I've seen the ball, an imaginary ball, leave my hand a quarter of a second before it did, and then the real ball left my hand, and then the imaginary ball would enter the basket one quarter of a second before the real ball did, and it happened over and over and over again in two different games, and I never missed a shot. And I wonder what the heck that was about, but I didn't think about it at the time. It wasn't until like two or three days later I thought, wait a minute, what was going on there? Because it seemed so natural. It's probably referred back to what Crichton said, that we have these things, but we've just forgotten how to bring them forward. I bring them forward sometimes in pressure situations by manipulating my hormones. Sometimes if I am choking under pressure, I use anger very briefly for a couple of seconds to get a lot of the adrenaline and get some testosterone, dopamine in my system. And by getting angry, it gives me extra physical and mental power. But then I've got to transfer it very quickly into whatever it is I'm doing, whether it's playing basketball, typing to deadline pressure for a story. Tiger Woods and the athletes do this quite a bit without having a name for it. I call it the alliance of emotions, but an argument could be made, Gia, that a guy like Tiger Woods in his prime, although he's got a lot of training, a lot of experience, he actually wills the ball into the hole in the golf tournament sometimes when the pressure's on. I think that's part of fight or flight. So we've been talking about a number of things here. The psychic abilities may be somewhat related to that, but they may be a separate entity in themselves.
Yeah, you know, you're talking about the using anger and whatnot. Years ago, I gave lectures for a tourist destination. You might call them sort of edutainment sort of presentations. And I did the same presentation 8-10 times a day.
You didn't come back with a poll, did you?
No. No polls involved.
Okay.
Anyhow, you know, during the time period in which I was giving these, I had some major life changes. My son died. I was giving those things even while I was breathing intensely. I got divorced. I had my ex attack me and came back to work with, you know, still a very vividly purple head and face and whatnot, which was a huge loss of face for anyone to have to appear in public after a domestic violence issue, and so forth and so on. So, you know, I was doing this, and sometimes I was going through went through a knee injury in which I was a lot of pain. I went through some very painful dental work that included ending up with a perforated sinus and so forth and so on. So, you know, a lot of things were going on, you know, that normally would make you really not want to get up in front of a crowd of people, especially that many times a day. Anyhow, you know, when I would do it, I found that it relieved me from all those things, the pain, it relieved me from the grief, it relieved me from, you might say, the embarrassment after the incident with my ex-husband, and so forth and so on. All of a sudden, you know, when I went to give those presentations, it was like I wasn't me anymore, if that makes sense. It was like probably some sort of bizarre psychological disorder. But people who knew me said, you know, it's funny, when you go to do that, the pitch of your voice changes slightly. You change in the way you look, even. You know, they couldn't describe what they were talking about, but they said it's not like you, but it is you, which, you know, I found rather strange. But for me, it was like, you know, when I go to do it, it's like I flip a power switch on and I shut off me, because none of the stuff I was talking about had anything to do with me personally. So it wasn't a personal presentation I was giving. And so, you know, I would switch gears, and all of a sudden I didn't have to deal with any of the stuff that was me for the next 14 minutes, which was, my presentation was 14 minutes long.
Yes.
You know, and I think that's very common with anyone who is a performer of any kind, whether you're a public speaker, a singer, a musician, whatever. There's a part of you that you have to switch gears and turn off yourself. That ego, of the part of you that can get bruised or battered or whatever, and you turn on the part that says, I am the owner of this space right now.
You just described,
you know, is it psychological or is it psychic? Yeah. I don't know.
I know one thing. You've just described perfectly a fight or flight experience. I've had many of those. As I said earlier, when you feel pressured, especially public speaking, professional speaking, I'm a professional speaker as well, you turn into a different person chemically. In fact, there is a branch or an offshoot of fight or flight, which is called tachypsychia. That's Greek for speed of the mind. In a really threatening situation, it seems like things are happening in slow motion, whether it's cops in a gun battle or an automobile accident. But what happens is nature is giving you the action one frame at a time to help you get out of that situation. So it seems like things are happening in slow motion. Another dynamic of that, and I don't know if you've had this, but I've had it, where when you're speaking or when I'm in the zone, it's almost like an out-of-body experience where, yes, it's not like you. You're almost watching someone who's inhabiting your body going through with this incredible talk. And I'm sure that's largely rooted in fight or flight. There's more to it than that. But I think some people are more naturally what I would call adrenaline sensitive. You may be psychic sensitive as well, but some people seem to be predisposed to using their adrenaline for positive things rather than choking. Most people have to get up in front of a crowd, they choke. In fact, most of these surveys, what are your greatest fears? There's two that come to mind all the time. At the top of the list is death and professional speaking, or speak any kind of speaking. And Jerry Seinfeld said, he had a perfect line for that. He said, that means if you're at a funeral, you'd rather be in the casket than giving the eulogy. But it sounds, there's more to it than, that's a good one, isn't it? There's more to it than that.
Yeah, because, it is.
Gee, I think you have also probably, before you get up and talk, you probably have a good command of what you're going to talk about. So I think what happens here is the fight or flight, the tachypsychia hormones, they act as an additive to your training and your confidence. And you can actually perform better under pressure than you can without. So I think that's why you seem like a different person. It's you. It's just a slightly altered and a more productive version of you.
Yeah, I will admit, I will deliberately put myself in a position where I do feel that pressure because I am more creative, more, I see things in a much clearer way. And I'm much more confident in a high-pressure situation than I am in a very casual, laid-back sort of way, if that makes any sense. Most people, when they listen to me, like on the radio or when I'm giving a in-person presentation, and they never believe me when I say I am one of the most intensely shy people you will ever meet, or not meet. Even by nature, I would never talk to a stranger. And so, you know, like I tell people, I have this little green guy sits on my shoulder, and his name is Fear. And I'll get scared the day he leaves, because he takes care of it for me. He's always whispering in my ear, you know, and he's watching around, but he's always there. He's there when I answer the telephone. Why would I want him to go away when I'm going to publicly speak?
Unfortunately,
I'd be lost. I mean, I'm used to him sitting there.
Unfortunately, this is a short-term thing. If we did this all day, every day, we'd burn out. We need extensive recovery period because these hormones are working like mad for us, but they can also burn out. In fact, that's why type A personalities often burn out. But getting back to what you're saying earlier, these terrible tragedies you've had and you've survived them, that gives me some more evidence that you are adrenaline sensitive. You are not only probably a performer, but you are a survivor. And I think you're probably partly predisposed to that. I'm not sure about your other siblings were like that, but you seem to be built as a survivor. And the old saying goes that what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. But I can maybe just getting back a bit to this poltergeist activity, because I know this is related somewhat to it, but your listeners may be saying, Clarkson, what the heck are you doing here? You're spending all your time talking about fear, although I think it's interesting.
Well, you know, fear is one of the poltergeist's strongest tools. They scare the dickens out of people, and it seems to feed it.
Yes. Well, I think it comes out of the, as I say, the cases I studied, mainly adolescents, and they're sometimes or often troubled to begin with, but they certainly come from what they think is a troubled home where there's lots of tension, lots of anxiety. And as I said earlier, they seem to have no other way to get attention but to make this stuff happen. But they don't really know. They seem to think they're doing it, but they certainly don't know how they're doing it. And I'm not saying in my book that I have evidence that poltergeist energy exists, but I come to this subject with a lot of people backing me up, and those people are police officers. Even beyond that case I mentioned in St. Catharines, where a shift of police officers for 2 weeks saw this incredible stuff, they said, I found over the years 51 cops who have gone back to their precincts and wrote written reports that they've seen poltergeist energy or activity. Now, cops, I listen when cops say this because they tend to be even more skeptical than newspaper reporters. Sometimes
I worked in law enforcement. They are very skeptical.
Yeah. So they got a lot to lose, GIF. If they say something happened, then I think probably something happened, even though eyewitness reports are generally seen as the weakest part of evidence in any psychic or paranormal case. And that's another problem with RSPK and PK. Mainstream science does not accept it because a lot of the testing done is inconclusive. As I mentioned about Sarah, she went to Laurentian University and she couldn't perform on demand. Now, there's for your listeners, if they want to go onto YouTube, they can YouTube this woman and see some videos of her. And her name was Nina Kulagina, K-U-L-A-G-I-N-A. She is one of the most compelling cases of evidence for PK. In the 1950s and 60s, there was allegedly some poltergeist activity in her apartment when she was a young person. Many Soviet scientists, including two Nobel laureates, were so interested, they took her to labs for 30 years, testing her under very tight, closely controlled conditions. And they claimed she could move things by her mind by focusing tightly. She was sometimes put into a cage to prevent trickery, or she was forced to move things in a plexiglass cube with video cameras rolling. And no one ever caught her cheating. And as you know, scientists, especially Soviet scientists, I guess at that time, probably very skeptical. So I think that's one of the better cases. Now, in the United States in recent years, there have been some testing for PK in a lab at Princeton University, which is no longer operating, but there was a respected scientist there by the name of Professor Robert John, J-A-H-N. He believed that he and his colleagues had produced good experimental data to support the existence of mind over matter. He said that some people have been able to influence small balls and pendulums by the force of their mind, but again, inconclusive, certainly not enough to convince mainstream science. And if the scientists and the skeptics, many skeptics, don't see it happen themselves, then it didn't happen. And unfortunately, we seem to be entering an era where there seems to be fewer research dollars. I'm not sure in paranormal sense in general, but I know in poltergeist cases, some of these labs and PK cases, some of these labs have closed down. The Princeton lab closed down. Seems like there's fewer government funds available for research. And William Rule, the chap in Georgia, is now semi-retired, and there doesn't seem to be anybody right now who's taking up the torch for him as far as poltergeist research goes. So it's not a very rosy picture right now for research. But hopefully, books like mine and shows like yours can add some exposure to the subject.
Well, you know, I don't know what it is. I don't know what is powering psychic events. I've seen it done too often. I've seen a lot of fakes, too. Okay, I'll admit that. I've seen a lot of fakes. Some are better fakes than others, but I have seen a number of fakes in the field. And I lived in New Orleans for a number of years. You know, you want to find a fake psychic, I can guarantee you can find one there. There's real ones, too. And it's hard for the average person to distinguish. It's not always easy for me to pick out fakes, even though I have observed lots and lots of different kinds of psychics in action. It's still hard for me to figure out, okay, who really knows what's going on and who's just really good at reading body language. Because we do give, most people don't realize that we give away a lot of clues when we are talking to someone about whether or not they're getting in the right ballpark with their statement, you might say. So when you have a psychic say, you know, something about siblings or grandparents, someone is deceased, it doesn't take very long for them to eliminate and figure out which way to go, simply because they're observant. It doesn't take that long to figure out what a person wants to hear, too. And a lot of that, the marketing is about telling you what you want to hear. So with all that going on, it's no wonder that we have trouble getting people to take events like Poltergeist and psychic energies and so forth and so on as being real, because it is tough to weed out the fakes from the real ones.
And
oftentimes, people who have apparently been real all along will, for some reason, run into a block or whatever, and one time of being caught as a fake will completely discredit them for life.
Yes, and this has happened a number of times in poltergeist cases, which I studied. In fact, I call this, it may be a little different with younger people, because I think sometimes you have legitimate poltergeist energy seemingly in a case, and the case goes on for a few weeks, and the energy, for some reason or other, dissipates, and the kids can't do it anymore, but they like the attention. They like the attention they got initially, the parents, the neighbors, the police, the media, the scientists. And when it goes away, they still want the attention. Kids are kids. And they'll do things like pulling down a lamp, and then, as you say, yes, it just casts a light on all the previous evidence. And the baby tends to get thrown out with the bathwater. We had a case in Columbus, Ohio, 1984, 14-year-old girl, similar to what I just said. And I, by the way, I call this the when the circus comes to town syndrome, when all the people, the media come in, and the kids can't do it anymore. They sometimes, like this girl, Tina Reich, pull down a lamp in with a camera rolling. And then someone like skeptic James Randi, the amazing Randi, who was there, he says, aha, see, I told you, there was nothing to this case. And someone like the amazing Randi gets a lot of publicity. So the mainstream public comes away after reading the newspaper reports with the idea that, yeah, this girl was the fake all along, but it's much more complex than that. And I think a lot of super-natural things, or paranormal, or whatever you want to call it, are very complex, and it's easy for mainstream media, mainstream science to dismiss them because there's loopholes. And as you said earlier, there are some who are just outright frauds. In fact, I have a whole chapter in my book, a long chapter on frauds in poltergeist cases. In fact, it's quite easy these days to fake a video on you. I mentioned YouTube earlier. And I think the videos of Nina Kulagina are legitimate, but people say to me, well, Michael, if there really are poltergeists, why haven't we seen a video? Well, it's just so hard to separate the wheat from the chaff, because you could fake a video, and who the heck knows it? You look on YouTube, some of these things look like they're very legitimate. So,
yeah. I mean, kids today are very skilled at doing all sorts of video tricks and that's all it is. It's just, I saw one, it was supposed to be a second movie, and, you know, the first movie was rather warm and fuzzy and kid-friendly, and this next one was supposed to be somewhat gory and gruesome and whatnot, and it appeared to be featuring the same people that had acted in the first movie, and then 20 years later, showing them as adults participating in the second movie, and it's all fake. It was just footage from various things put together quite skillfully by someone with a computer. And it was done as a joke, and it was very, very good. I have to admit, it was a really, if you didn't know that this was a fake, you would take it as a real trailer. In fact, the number of people I showed it to thought it was a real trailer for a new movie.
Now, that's a good segue into another little subject here. I know we've only got a few minutes to go, but the entertainment aspect, if your listeners think about Poltergeist in regards to the Poltergeist movies, then I think there's it's going to be difficult to make the link. After studying all these cases, I can find really nothing what relates to, let's say, the original movies, Poltergeist series in the 1980s. They were very entertaining, and they continue to be, not only on in the movies, but now that this genre on TV, very growing, very popular genre of PSI and poltergeist activity and paranormal. But I think most of these things are for entertainment. The poltergeist, original poltergeist movie, if I remember, it was on a the house where the girl that was making the activity go was over an Indian burial site. And that's how the there were some ghosts from, I guess, the cemetery who were causing this girl to go through the TV set. I enjoyed that movie, but I think we go to these movies and videos and televisions for entertainment and not necessarily science. But it is very easy for a borderline skeptic to get the two mixed up.
Yeah, and a lot of times people get confused by terms. The terminology itself isn't clear in their head. And, you know, they do what I call an Archie Bunker, and they use the wrong word to refer to a phenomena, and, you know, it further muddies the waters, you might say. And poltergeist, you know, well, why don't you give the audience a nice, clear definition of what a poltergeist really is?
Yeah. It's, as I said earlier, RSPK, bizarre movements of objects, noises, and other paranormal effects caused unconsciously, usually by a person. The person has an unusual brain, usually, and can tap into a nearby energy source, but they don't know how they do it. In fact, science, the parapsychologists don't seem to know how they do it because other than the PK, the RSPK is even more difficult to prove because the families don't let the investigators in until usually the RSPK has diminished. If we just got a couple of minutes here, I wanted to get one other segment in. Tia, is that okay?
Sure.
Yeah, I have a little section in the back of my book called Help for the Victims, and otherwise, if you have a poltergeist-type activity going on in your house, how do you get rid of it? Most cases of RSPK seem to die a natural death after a few weeks. And sometimes it eases with the easing of stress in a household. Sometimes the occurrences end when the agent, he or she, realizes that they are the cause. Other times, psychotherapy seems to help. Now, I haven't really got into the area of ghosts or possession. There seems to be a few cases of that, but exorcisms don't seem to work. However, clergy and parapsychologists report some relief to the victims when they counsel a family. And there is a British psychologist by the name of Dr. John Layard. He says that poltergeists are not chance phenomena, but have a definite purpose. It is a curative one, having for its object the resolution of a psychological conflict. Often the poltergeist agent has no other way to relieve the unusual buildup of frustration or tension, whether it is psychological or sexual.
Uh-huh.
And there you have it. I'm not saying there may not be some cases what involve ghosts or spirits, but it just seems in the main we are dealing here with haunted people rather than haunted places.
Yeah, it definitely sounds like that. And I know in, you know, you might say my own case when we were kids, the poltergeist activity always occurred during periods of incredible stress within our family.
Yes.
And once my parents divorced and we moved out of the house, my father continued living in the same house, and I went back to live, you know, a couple of years later for a semester of school. And once again, my stepbrother and sister were there, and my stepbrother was going through puberty. It did not recur.
Mm.
So there were no more incidents of flying pots and pans and so forth and so on. It was a very normal house. So it was probably strictly related to the intense stress that we were under as a family. And, you know, the three kids there again, and we're all going through various stages of puberty.
Now, you having said that, makes me wonder if there are not more poltergeist cases than have been reported. In other words, you didn't seem to think it was that big of a deal, so maybe there's a lot of other families out there who've had this type of occurrence.
We really didn't. I mean, it was inconvenient, but we certainly weren't calling the police about it.
Yes.
And, you know, the lack of reporting makes absolute sense to me. Even if I had gone through the same thing with my own kids, I would not have called the police about it. I mean, that's silly. What are the police going to do about a poltergeist? you know, there again. Yeah. So that's probably a good part of it. We have reached time for our break. I want to thank you very much for coming on and sharing that with us. I hope that it's enthralled everyone and that they can find your book on Amazon, Borders, any of the bookstores, right?
Yes, Barnes & Noble.
Okay. Well, folks, while we're away from your computer, check out our website, www.exogenynetwork.com. Stay tuned, and the Dawn of Shades will return with our second hour guest, Sean Bettelkuroff, and more about our topics tonight in just a few minutes.
The Church of Amadeus with hosts Jeffrey Richard and Guy Weddle. 10 p.m. Central Saturdays. Opening the gates of the underworld and calling down beings of ancient starlight. Tune in. Watch for the apocalypse on the Paranormal Radio Network. Come to our forum at mavisincarnate.com. Light up your night with The Kevin Smith Show. Hi, this is Kevin Smith. Join me Monday through Friday right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
The Unabridged Universe. Join us from 7 to 9 Central Standard Time, Saturdays, as host Jason Wilson and I, Victoria Rose, bring you the perspectives of guests on every topic, from extraterrestrials on the edge of the galaxy to issues that affect you right here at home. It's a big universe out there, and we're likely to cover anything. Do you have any topics that you'd like to have discussed? Know any researchers or free thinkers out there you'd like to have on the show? Log on to www.unabridgeduniverse.com and let us know, only on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Hi, I'm Gia Scott. I'm the host of this really cool little radio program on Tuesday nights from 7 to 9 p.m. It's called The Dawn of Shades. I bring in a wide variety of guests, and we talk about all sorts of things. Some of them are authors, some of them are experiencers, but it's all paranormal. Do tune in to The Dawn of Shades from 7 to 9 p.m. Tuesdays, and you can always catch our guest list at www.giascott.com.
Are you interested in a radio program that focuses on the deeper aspects of the UFO topic? Would you like to explore the facts and truths of what ufology and UFO research are all about? Please join us here every Saturday evening at 7 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Central for Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis, with your host, D. Andrew, right here on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network. Remember, UFO research is not a belief system.
Hi. You've got to listen to ICAR, that's International Community for Alien Research, www.icar1.com. I should know, I'm Irish.
Tree Sheridan, host of A Global Focus. Broadcasts resume Friday nights from 10 to 12 Eastern on the Paranormal Radio Network. Come join the discussion.
Hi, I'm psychic medium Chris George.
And I'm Stephanie Benetti.
And we're Second Sight NYC, a psychic and paranormal radio show based out of New York City.
And Chris is a psychic that tells it like it is.
So if you want something sugar-coated,
just buy a donut.
Each week we'll have an interesting guest, and I'll do psychic readings and dream interpretations with a psychic twist.
We touch on all that is paranormal, from exorcisms to ghost hunting.
From seances to passing spirits in the light.
Yeah, and sometimes Chris gets a little carried away.
But Stephanie's always there to reel me back in. We're making the unbelievable believable.
Join us.
Tune in to UFO Undercover, Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern, with your host, Joe Montaldo, right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Just how you feel.
back to the Dawn of Shades. I'm your host, Gia Scott, with our guest for the second hour, which is now going to be November Hansen, as our scheduled guest apparently has gotten swallowed up by technology somehow. While I've got everybody here, I'd like to remind everyone to visit our website, www.exogenynetwork.com. You can sign up for the newsletter, wander around, explore the website, and let me know what you think of it. There are links there to take you to blogs, Twitter, and even Facebook. If you want to go straight to the blog, you can go to gscott.wordpress.com and even find out what kinds of things I'm up to lately. Now, tonight's topic earlier was all about poltergeist, very fascinating topic. Second hour, we're going to be just kind of talking about current events, a little ghostly stuff along the way, probably. If you would like to ask a question or make a comment, you can email me at scott@exogenynetwork.com, and I'll take it from there. If you're listening in on a podcast or think of it after the program is finished, you can go ahead and send it to me as well. I'll do my best to get your questions answered. Now, if you're in the virtual auditorium, you can put it in the text there, and I'm trying very hard to catch it as the screen scrolls. And if you want our call-in number, our number is 504-273-7379. So with that, welcome to the program, November.
Well, hello, Georgia. I believe there is a vast conspiracy going on within the Paranormal Radio Network. I am not being allowed to retire.
Yes, I know. I think you've been on the radio more since you retired from radio than you were normally. That's not a bad thing.
So.
Everybody likes to hear from you.
No, it's not.
Yeah, so I know you live on the West Coast, and while we're still on break, we brought up the subject of Japan's recent nuclear disaster and the radiation that's been spreading out from it. You know, I know on Facebook there has been a lot of postings about all of Japan's being evacuated and whatnot. A lot of rumors that are not based on truth. But the current rumor is that there has been radiation found in Portland. Have you heard anything about that?
No, I was just checking. I've seen the Facebook postings. Honestly, I think it just goes with the territory. Whenever you have a natural disaster or some kind of oddity in the world, you have things like, you know, conspiracy theories and HARPs doing it and UFOs did it and the aliens are after us. And, you know, it's some country that started this whole, I don't know. It just gets crazy. No, I have not heard any. I think there was a little blip in our local news that we had a little bit of radiation, and that was it. And the only reason why we had those things to begin with is we used to have the Trojan nuclear power plant.
Uh-huh. Well, you know, a lot of people don't realize that there's a natural amount of radiation that each one of us is exposed to every single day. It doesn't have anything to do with technology, nuclear power plants, secret government conspiracies, or anything else. It's just the normal radiation that's found on this planet. That's called background radiation. A lot of the levels that are being reported are possibly slightly up from the normal for that particular area, because it does vary in, according to different parts of the country. But I haven't seen anything showing a substantial raise in the continental U.S. You know, as
nope,
far as what's being
either.
Reported
you know what they
in
need
terms
to do,
of science. Pardon?
You know what they need to do? They can make this so simple. All they got to do is put a chart up in the major media, because, you know, everybody believes what the major media says. And then on the chart, they put, you know, what the radiation levels are called, and it's, shoot, the name just skipped off the top of my head. And then what they do is that they make this thing that says, if there's this, sieverts, if there's this many sieverts, this is the type of exposure you may have had, 2 hours in the sun, your cell phone, microwave, whatever, and keep going up the list. If people have that guide to look at and they realize how many sieverts are being reported in Portland, they'll start laughing.
Yeah, you know, I guess one good case, because everybody associates it with nuclear activity and technology and governments and everything. Years ago, I had planned a trip with a friend to the Taos area, and we were going to go to the Mandy Hot Springs, which are located in the Rio Grande Gorge, just outside of Taos. And it was a great trip. Hiking down to the gorge at dawn was just absolutely amazing. It was in November, so it's really cold. You're hiking down to the gorge, to the hot springs. You get to the hot springs, there's the steam rising, the Rio Grande is rushing past, icy cold, right literally arm's length from the springs themselves. And then you're standing there and you strip off your outer clothes and you're wearing your swimsuit underneath and you climb into the hot springs just as the sun's coming up, you know. And you're sitting in this warm water and steam's rising off your body and the cold water rushing past. And I looked at my friend and I said, you know, when I was reading about this place and how awesome it was, it said the water's full of radon. I said, what is radon? Well, now I know. It's a radioactive element that's found in areas with lots of natural thermal activity. It's part of our natural environment, but in large quantities, it can cause typical radioactive sort of problems. We were bathing in it. Our skin felt wonderful afterwards, too. That's been about a decade ago now, I guess, maybe nine or ten years. And so far, I haven't shown any weird skin growths or anything like that. But yeah, so you know, that's an example of being exposed to a radioactive element. Okay, radon was the only thing reported in the water out of the norm because supposedly it was supposed to be so healthy for you, way back in the heyday of natural springs and whatnot. And our skin did feel wonderful. Someone in the virtual auditorium asked if our skin was glowing. We might have been glowing, but it was probably more from the barely above freezing air when we got out of the hot springs than it was from the water itself. Yeah, we didn't glow in the dark at all. But, you know, there is radiation everywhere. A lot of things that we use every day has radioactive elements, like the mantles for lanterns that you use camping. Those are considered radioactive. Is it handling a mantle going to harm us? No, but you should wash your hands after you put it on the lantern. And I wouldn't recommend sleeping with several cases of them under your bed. But outside of that, no. You know, we get exposed to it when we get x-rays. You know, I don't know if we get exposed to radiation when we go through those body scanners that TSA has in the airports or not. But
I'm sure you do.
Because I really don't know anything about them. Pardon?
I'm sure there is some level of radiation, probably extremely small.
Yeah, you know, I used to say that if I ever got cancer caused by radiation, it was going to be in my knee because I had to have it x-rayed so many times growing up. It seemed like my one knee seemed to take the brunt of every crash. So far, no signs of cancer in my knee, and I hope it stays that way. But, you know, that is an example of radioactive radiation sorts of things. They're everywhere. We deal with them all the time. You know, once upon a time, x-ray machines were a carnival sort of event. I mean, people just did it for the heck of it. We now know that's not a good idea. But we've gotten a little bit more educated about what it is. I can't remember the name of the guy who invented it, but it seems to me he died of cancer. Well, he played with the radiation a lot. Radiation techs now wear a little gizmo to record the amount of radiation that they're exposed to. They don't stand in the room with the patient when they're being x-rayed and so forth and so on. So things have changed. Yep, the name was posted in the room, William Rentgen, that was his name. Anyhow, that is radiation and us today. Now, I remember when Chernobyl happened, okay? Chernobyl was a massive-sized disaster. I remember everybody pretty much predicting we were all going to sprout two heads and have horrible disfigurations and so forth and so on. Now, that's something very real for the people who lived in the area, but for those of us in the United States, nothing happened. You know, what's your take? Do you think we are looking at potential problems from the Japanese nuclear disaster, or do you think it's much more hyped than reality?
You know, Georgia, because it's an ongoing event, I would say it's something to watch. I don't believe at this point in time right now today as we're sitting here that there's any grave danger to us. But, as I said, it's an ongoing event, and we're not talking about one reactor. We're talking about reactors that have had problems. They're still experiencing aftershocks. They could get a big enough one to do more damage. They do keep referring to one of the reactors as having plutonium as opposed to uranium. Now, I haven't really looked that up myself to see what the differential is, but the one plutonium seems to be more threatening than the uranium. They don't seem to think there's a threat of an explosion. Now, if that happened, that would put the stuff into the atmosphere and probably threaten a lot of people like Chernobyl. They think it's bigger than the Three Mile Island, which I would agree because I believe that was one reactor that had a problem there. You know, it's an ongoing event, so who knows? I would say because nothing like this has happened, even the experts themselves are not sure what the potential is of what could happen.
That's true. That's very true. And in addition, a lot of people don't feel that the Japanese government is being very open about disclosing exactly what is going on from that particular nuclear plant, that they're withholding information. I'm not that familiar with the Japanese media or the Japanese government, for that matter. You know, it's just, it's something that, it seems a possibility that they could be suppressing information being released about the problem. I can really only compare it to our own government, and very few people have confidence in our own government's tendency to disclose information. So it's logical to assume that the Japanese government is also withholding information. You know, I've read some news reports that say that China is demanding more disclosure. It affects China much, much quicker than it does us. I mean, China's, what is it, like 50 miles difference between the Chinese coastline and Japan? Not very far distance.
No, that's true. I would think, you know, I don't know. Maybe it depends on which way the currents are going, what way the jet stream is going. I'm sure when Chernobyl happened, there were areas in the immediate vicinity that weren't affected because they weren't, you know, in the direct, you know, the stuff is, like they were saying in the media, it is invisible. And so, you know, we got little meters and instruments that can measure it. But for the most part, the part of the fear factor of it is it isn't like, you know, it's not like facing an earthquake with a damaged building and trying to figure out how to go about fixing it. You're trying to fix something that you really can't even see.
Yeah, yeah. And then we have all of the rumors hitting the Internet, which the Internet is a great source of information, but it's also a great source of misinformation. You know, the latest thing I saw coming across was an accusation that it's a conspiracy on the part of Japan. It's a secret attack on the United States. You know, I look at the situation and I'm thinking, this is a really crappy way to attack another country, especially that far away. In order to, you know, send enough radiation to the United States to really cause problems, they're pretty much going to be destroying themselves, won't they? You know, I don't know what's your opinion, because I know neither one of us are nuclear scientists, but, you know, we both are reasonably well-educated adults and, you know, sort of the average James of America, and we read this information and go look up things to find out how far out in left field it really is. Are there still dandelions, or are we even past the dandelions? In my opinion,
okay, I would be more likely to believe in a mass evacuation as opposed to an attack. And I don't believe either one of them. I mean, that's just, I think people just get bored and they like to invent things. And they're those type of people that like to sit and watch the drama unfold and they get some kind of thrill about it.
Yeah, maybe even they get the thrill from seeing how far their falsely planted seed can grow. You know, because there again, I'm looking at it, and I'm like, attack on the United States but by having a nuclear meltdown in Japan? That's like saying, I'm going to amputate my toe by piercing my ear, as far as I can tell. I mean, they don't even appear to be related. You know, let alone any discord between the two countries that would even feed such a rumor. I don't get it, you know.
Georgie, what's,
now, if
what's
somebody had said the same thing, if
happened?
It happened in China, people might be saying the same thing. And, you know, we all have seen the contaminated goods from coming from China, and there's a lot of animosity over that. But even there, I can't really see it.
What's wrong with just going with the real news story? There is a massive earthquake. The massive earthquake generated a tsunami. The building was damaged in the earthquake. The reactors were damaged in the tsunami. Why is that? Why would that be so hard to believe that you have to create all these other things?
Well, yeah. See, the earthquake was supposedly caused by the American harp. Did you forget that part of the conspiracy?
Okay, so the Americans caused the earthquake because they wanted to destroy Japan because they didn't like them being the third world or the world's third largest economy. So to retaliate, Japan let its nuclear reactors just go wild and rampant. It sounds like something out of a storybook.
Not a good story. No, I mean, it's really, you know, if you wrote this up as a fictional tale that way, I don't think you'd find anyone to publish the story, to be honest, because it's pretty far-fetched. You know, it's calling for a number of conspiracies and a new world order and all that kind of stuff, and it's like, yee-haw. You know, it just, I can't see that as being a conspiracy. It looks to me like, as the saying goes, an act of nature, and it unfortunately damaged a nuclear reactor, and now they're working to get it shut down. Have you heard how far they are towards getting those reactors shut down?
No.
But I didn't have time to check that before the show.
I have not had any time to check on it recently. You know, the other thing that could happen here is that people are impatient and they like new news. After a while, that might not become exciting anymore, so there could still be an ongoing crisis like the frogs, and people just sort of forget about it until it comes knocking on their door again. And, you know, the news media gets bored and they move on to something else, and I don't know. It's a very strange situation, and who knows what's being told the truth, who knows what's propaganda, everybody does it. No governments are completely honest. Come on. You know.
Yeah.
But I mean, if you just look at what
no one likes to put themselves in the bad in the bad guy scenario. All right.
Right.
You know, a lot of people are saying, well, this nuclear plant was old and it should have been shut down, blah 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 blah. Well, you know, hindsight's 20/20 and all that. I'm sure, you know, Japan as a country doesn't want to lose face in terms of the nuclear reactor. But at the same time, this is now a problem that faces the world, not just Japan. And as such, you know, a lot of countries have a major interest in this getting shut down as quickly as possible.
You know, Georgia, if we wanted to be a little mysterious about it, maybe we could say it has something to do with an awakening, you know, with us as a species taking a look at the type of energy that we use. Is this viable? Could there be some other kind of accident that would create something even more, you know, catastrophic that we haven't really thought about? Maybe it's that awakening to reflect. I mean, if you want to be kind of mysterious and sort of paranormal about it, I think you could probably throw that into the curve and not sound too wild and kooky. But some of the other stuff, I mean, I haven't heard the one where Allah sent the earthquake because he was out to destroy Western powers. I haven't got that one yet. I'm sure it's coming.
That's probably next week. That's probably next week. I did read a headline. I didn't read the article, but I did read a headline tonight when I was surfing through the headlines, is that chicken fat is now being, experiments being conducted with it to create jet fuel for the U.S. Air Force.
Can
now,
you
I found
see
that
those
very
new chicken farms? Everybody's going to want a chicken farm. It's going to stink.
Yeah, chicken fat. You know, I've had some fat chickens in my day. It was a result of feeding corn and not having time to butcher until they were a couple weeks past butcher time. They were very fat chickens. I was surprised that none of them had died of a heart attack. They were so fat. But it took a lot of corn to get them that fat. I know I was buying the corn and carrying it in and feeding the chickens. You know, but chicken fat, you know, I just never thought of it as a jet fuel. Why chicken fat? Why not lard or tallow or something else?
I have no clue. What? I couldn't even begin. Yeah. If I would have thought of something like that, I would have thought it was the most ridiculous idea in the world. So I guess it's a good thing we have down the properties of chicken fat and discover that it could be a potential jet fuel.
Yeah, you know, well, I think back 6 months ago on some television channel, there was a program about survivors. In this particular series, they were set in New Orleans, and that's where they were starting off with their survivor show. And they cooked a bunch of spoiled pork into to render out the fat in it to use as a form of diesel. Now, from their reaction, very glad there was no smell-o-vision, because apparently spoiled, rotten pigs smell real bad. I could skip the aroma myself. Cooking it probably just really brought out the aroma to get the fat off of it. Yet, as far as I'm aware, as for alternative fuels, lard has never been mentioned as a biodiesel.
I know
that, like, recycled cooking oil from fast food restaurants and stuff, that's used to fuel some alternative fuel vehicles, and then it supposedly smells like French fries when they're going down the road. But I just never have heard of.
So do they put, like, McDonald's stickers on the back of them or Sonic or something like that, so when people smell the French fries driving down the road, they want to run to the... I mean, I could see an advertising gimmick in this.
Well, no, actually, it's not really even... I've never heard anybody propose such a thing. But, yeah, I could see that, too.
You know, the Georgia Market.
Pardon?
I was going to say, you have to admit, there is something a little unusual going on in our world today. I mean, we're seeing a lot of fairly significant events in a very short period of time. And I'm hearing people talk about, you know, things like not necessarily the end of the world, but more like a change is going to have to come, a change is going to have to take place because everything's happening so rapidly. You know, we're having a hard time keeping up. We got the sweeping events over in the Middle East going on. I mean, if somebody told me 10 years ago that I'd be sitting here today and this is what I would be looking at in the world holistically, I probably would have laughed. I mean, I could have never envisioned, you know, these types of events occurring. So will more follow suit? That's I think, is one of the big questions, you know, for me, is that we are going through some kind of a change, and how much more is going to follow suit? Will we see these uprisings, you know, against governments actually, you know, spread into areas that we never even thought of? And I know that's a long way from biodiesel and chicken fat, but I mean, I couldn't help but, you know, think, you know, years ago when people talked about an awakening and looking at what things happening, and there's actually a lot of excited people out there. They want to see a change. They want to see a great shift, if you will, something that's going to create jobs, it's going to bring about prosperity. You know, we're not going to end world hunger overnight, that's for sure, because we're too stupid to figure it out. But it really does seem like that epitaph, or whatever that big word is with the pyramid at the top, is starting to take place. I kind of hope so. I find it sort of exciting.
Well, you know, nobody can deny there's changes. And, you know, when you look at it with hindsight, the real changes seem to start happening with the breaking apart of the Soviet Union. You know, in terms of politics, okay? The Soviet Union broke apart at the end of the Cold War. Lots of changes really started happening, and as time has gone on, it's like a snowball building up momentum. And now we've got an incredible amount of changes going on, and it makes me wonder what is going to be going on next year, because that snowball gets bigger and bigger.
Next year,
you know, what other kinds of things? Pardon?
Well, next year, what about next month? I mean, it really
is. You know, and then we've got the whole 2012 thing. You know, on December 21st, 2012, the world is coming to an end. Yeah. You know, I've talked to a lot of psychics. I'm sure you have, too. And that's something that comes up all the time because everybody's like, the world is coming to an end on December 21st, 2012. Do you see that as even being within the realm of possibilities?
Oh, I think that possibility is always with us. I mean, come on, we're a little planet floating around in space. We could be hit by a gigantic asteroid any day. I mean, you know, those kinds of threats will always be there. There have been extinction-level events on this planet more than once. You know, there used to be dinosaurs. There used to be mammoths. I mean, you know, there used to be a lot of things that aren't here anymore. And so they do happen. Diseases happen that wipe out mass amounts of population. I mean, those events are always going to be around. It's not like we're ever just going to be 100% safe. The world will just keep ticking the way it does for eternity. As far as something happened, I don't know about all these dates things. I mean, I kind of was interested in it when I was younger. It was, you know, I guess from the standpoint is, you know, could somebody really predict something happening in the future? I don't know. Maybe. You know, however, you know, we just had that big quake in Japan. Let's say there was another equal quake like that. I don't know, somewhere. Let's don't pick on the United States. Let's pick on London. Let's say they had a big 9.0 quake. You know, just coming on the heels of this other one. And then 3 or 4 months later, there's another gigantic one. Let's pick on Australia. You know, if you've seen those kind of events happening, then I might look at 2012 and say, you know, there might be something to it. Perhaps I better get a yard chair, a nice little drink, kick back, and watch everybody go crazy.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm a big advocate of preparedness. You know, keeping emergency supplies, having an emergency backpack, being prepared to evacuate, and so forth and so on. And part of it is because I live in hurricane country. I'm less than a mile from the Gulf of Mexico. Logic says I need to be prepared. This area's been hit numerous times and will be hit numerous times in the future. You know, will it be another Katrina? Maybe. It might be somebody, you know, with a name that means almost nothing because it's a mild storm. You know, we never know. And, you know, with hurricanes, you just have 3 days typically notice that it's coming to your area, and it may make landfall in your town, and it might make it 100 miles east or west of you. You never know for sure until it actually does so. We've seen hurricanes turn long at the last minute, too. Anyhow, you know, can you be prepared for everything, like the end of the world? You know, folks, anybody who's telling you to buy their kit to save yourself on December 21st, steer clear, because their kit's not going to help you. I guess I don't see the date as particularly significant. I just figure that the Aztecs ran out of rock at that point, or was it Mayans? I forget which one. But they ran out of rock at that point. It was Mayan calendar. So, you know, don't get all shook up. But their ages typically did not refer to end of worlds, but end of eras. Are we seeing the end of an era? Well, it looks like it might be. Are we going to have a golden age follow? It would be really nice. You know, I don't know about you, but I'm really kind of weary of continual war and conflict and disease and so forth and so on. You know, it's really time that we start actually becoming a little bit enlightened, perhaps, and learning to live on this planet in a kinder way, taking better care of it. Obviously, we're not going to get a new one anytime soon.
No, I don't have a problem with doing that at all. I always thought that you, you know, maybe it was just the way that I raised. If you had something, you take good care of it. When I bought a car, I was 16 years old. My parents, you know, drilled into me, take care of it. When I bought my house when I was 19, you know, take, and I did. I always took very good care. And I'm talking material things, but it went beyond that. You know, this is the land that you live on. Take care of it. Don't let it become a backyard junkyard. Don't let it, you know, become a dumping place for garbage, you know, that type of thing. You take care of the things you own. It doesn't matter whether it's the land you live on or the home you live in or, I don't know, your laptop. Be responsible and take care of. When you do that, you set examples for other people, you know, to do the same thing. To me, it's just common sense, but I think I'm beginning to think anymore, you got to teach. You know, global warming. Okay, so, you know, there's a lot of conflict about the whole global warming issue. Well, we've had, what, 24 days of rain now in the month of March. That's almost unheard of. Glaciers are melting. Hello, the water has to go someplace. This isn't rocket science. and but how much is man and how much is just the natural, you know, event of the planet? I don't think you can say man has no impact. You know, I think that would be totally ridiculous. Of course there's some impact, but trying to determine what it is. But, I mean, there's so many things that you can do that are just simple things. Don't throw your garbage out of your car. You'd be surprised how many people do that. It just amazes me. It's like they don't care. They don't care about the home that they were given, you know, whether it's a roof over their head or their entire planet. It doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah. You know, I know a lot of people do pitch everything out the window of the car without even giving it a second thought. You know, I know a lot of people that were always hollering about environmental concerns. I'd be out hiking with them. They thought nothing of throwing down a can or a bottle or a wrapper. It's like, pick that up and put that in your backpack. You brought it, you bring it home with you. You know, and it made me wonder, what are we doing when they're out on their own? Because I know that I have been 20 miles from the next road, and I've seen litter. How in the heck did it get up here? You know, somebody dropped it. They let it, you know, lay there for whatever reason. It's like, what was going through their head? I mean, they carried it up here. Why couldn't they carry it home with them? Because a lot of people really don't seem to care. I guess they figure they're never coming back here, so why worry about it? They think that can or bottle is just going to magically disappear. And we see a lot of people that just really don't have that much concern about the planet that we live on. I know that, you know, I do a lot of camping and hiking and whatnot, and we do take out novices, and it's a big deal to us to encourage people, you know, with this leave no trace thing. You don't cut down things when you're out there. You, if they're alive, you just don't cut them. You don't leave trash behind, and so forth and so on. And that, for some people, it's a pretty tough lesson. And you wonder, you know, did they learn it when they were out with us this weekend? Or, you know, are they going to come out here camping and leave all the crap behind? Because I've come up on campsites after people have left, literally seen 100 paper plates, clean, new ones, never been used, scattered everywhere, along with what looks like a whole box of napkins. It's like, you know, what was going on in their head? I have enough trash here to start 100 bonfires. And, you know, there we go. You know, it's just people don't seem to care. They think that, I guess, the world is their playground and the maid's coming afterwards. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm sitting here looking at the work release. How many people are going to, out of prison, be part of a work release program that picks garbage up on the highway, go apply for a job, and looking for one where you have experience of picking up garbage? It's like, come on. That's ridiculous. I'm here just on the freeways. It is convicts that generally do that. They do not get paid for it. The country roads, like where I live, there's a lot of people that, you know, go for country walks, and they pick up the garbage. They go with their bag and their rubber gloves, and I appreciate them very much. that do that. I've been to campsites where I've cleaned up after somebody else's mess myself just because I couldn't stand to look at it. I mean, I don't know why it's like that. I don't know if we can change that. I don't know if it's like that in other places in the world, or if, you know, we just kind of the spoiled little nation here that, you know, you can just do whatever you darn well please and, you know, devil be damned type of thing. I have no idea.
Yeah, I mean, you know, everybody I know, when you go out hiking, go out camping, go out fishing and whatnot, you end up bringing more trash than you brought with you. And then you have to dispose of it when you come back in. Should it be that way? No. People should care more. But I hear that out in the oceans, there are entire vast areas that are nothing but a floating island of garbage, plastic.
I can't
even imagine that.
What happened to the drums filled with spent nuclear fuel? That was big news like 30 years ago, being dumped into the oceans and they were leaking. They're probably still out there leaking.
Yeah. I was reading a thing about the best foods to buy for eating healthy, and talking about organic and natural and everything. And they said most of the organic food was more hype than you were actually getting in nutritional benefit. And the one thing you should never eat was fish. And I was like, whoa, I live in an area that depends on the fishing industry in many ways. Fishing is a big deal here. And he's saying the fish isn't safe to eat. Now, granted, we had the oil spill and the Gulf, and all those issues and the remarks about the toxic dispersants and the toxic oil. Oh, and the latest thing was mutant alien fish living in the deep water, on that rig that sunk there. And it's supposed to be made of metal, and it can swim through metal. Now, I watched the video on YouTube, and they look like normal fish to me, but apparently they have these mutant alien fish. I'm not sure how they mutated, but, I don't know, because you do see a lot of stuff. But those fish look pretty normal to me, watching that video footage of them swimming around the rig. And, there's a lot of people are saying that the fish in the Gulf aren't safe to eat. Well, here's where it comes in. The government that we all trust, right, has been testing these fish to make sure that they do not show any signs of contamination. The fish, the oysters, the shrimp, all of that. It's coming back safe to eat. I don't think anything of eating it. I tell other people it's perfectly safe to eat, but, I don't know. Would you eat it?
No. I'm not a big fish eater myself. I wouldn't care one way or another because I'm not going to eat the fish anyway. I mean, that sounds pathetic, but I don't know.
Well, I go fishing and I fish on the Pascagoula River, and we like to go right out to where it opens into the Gulf of Mexico. And the fishing is excellent there. And those fish swim in and out of the Pascagoula River, as they will may dictate, probably has something to do with tide and all that kind of stuff. I've seen dolphins. Now, I do know that we have heard a lot lately about increased infant dolphin mortality. Stillborn dolphins, baby dolphins all dying. Is it related to something to do with the oil spill, or is it something else? Who knows? But you do get a lot of kind of crackpot stuff that you read, and you're like, where's the data? I'm told all this stuff is happening in Pascagoula, and I haven't seen it. Does that mean anything? I don't know. I talk to people that go out and come back in, and nobody has seen anything weird or caught any deformed fish or anything. None of those metal fish. I really would like to see one of those metal fish, though. But we are nearing the end of the program. So I want to thank you very much for joining me tonight, November.
Yes, an impromptu guest. It was actually kind of fun. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I enjoyed it too. Folks, I hope that you have enjoyed the program with both November and Michael, and that you found that it provided you with plenty of food for thought and more illumination for your personal journey towards truth. Join us again next Tuesday, and we'll bring you along for another episode of The Dawn of Shades. Sure to be a fascinating conversation with our guests. With that, we are out of time. I'm your host, Gia Scott, and good night. The